Thanks. I have to apologize since I came a few minutes late to a couple of previous talks. I'm not quite sure this hasn't been done, but just in case it hasn't been done, can we all give a note of thanks to the organizers for putting together this night's workshop? All right, I'm supposed to tell you about high-speed cryptography. I've also had a little bit more loaded on me, like I'm supposed to tell you about doing complete addition laws for the NIST curves and for binary curves and, is there more? Now I'm in big trouble. Let me start by telling you something that at first glance is not even about cryptography. If you type the command shown up at the top there, dig plus DNS sec minus T N E S E at a.ns.se, whatever that means, at a Unix command line or Linux, or maybe works under Mac OS as well, then if you watch the network, there's a 31-byte packet that gets sent out to a server, a certain Sweden server, one of the Swedish government servers. And it sends back 3,974 bytes in response, sends back a packet to you. Now, if you want, you can change the address where you're sending this packet from. That takes a little bit more. It's not a standard Unix command to do it, but you can, instead of sending this from your laptop or your desktop machine, you can forge a return address of 198.41.0.4. And then the response from this Sweden server, whose address is 192.36.144.107, all the addresses on the internet look kind of random, the Swedish server sends its response back to the return address that you put on your request packet. It sends 3,974 bytes back to 198.41.0.4, wherever that is. You can put any return path that you want, any return address on the packet. And then you can do this again and again. You can have an army of thousands or hundreds of thousands of computers, each of which is sending a request to the Sweden servers. And, well, at some point the Sweden servers get overloaded, but then you can also do the same with some other servers. Exercise, find some more servers like this, and then do this again trillions and trillions of times over whatever time period, and that ends up flooding 198.41.0.4 with a lot more data than you were sending out. This is called an amplification attack, 100 times amplification attack of a distributed denial of service flood. Actually, it's not quite 100 times. When you look at 31 up to 3974, there's some headers on the packets at a very low level, so actually it's more like 73 bytes that you're sending out plus a little extra for your physical layer. But it's a pretty serious expansion factor. This is actually the worst expansion factor I've ever seen for any internet protocol. Now, what does 198.41.0.4 do about this? Well, it dies. It falls off the internet. Certainly while the flood is going, maybe the computer doesn't crash, but the network is overloaded or the CPU is overloaded with all of these packets coming in. Now, the 198.41.0.4 server is one of the actually root DNS servers on the internet. My next slide is about the .com servers, which are you can also flood in exactly the same way. The company that runs .com, called VeriSign, and also runs certificate authority, various other things, they've been spending a fair amount of money. On their scale of money, they get something like $1 billion a year, so it's maybe not so much that they're spending, but they're spending $100 million, U.S. dollars, sorry, I know I'm in Canada here, $100 million U.S. dollars to upgrade the .com servers. And what is this upgrade paying for? Well, there's actually some pretty serious load on the servers. They published statistics several months ago for what the servers were doing on a typical day. And on that day, there were 5 million different clients asking the .com servers for information. Where's Google.com? Where's AOL.com? Where's CNN.com? And those 5 million clients sent in 35 billion queries. Of course, some clients were individual machines just sending a few queries every day, but then there were some very busy clients sending lots of queries. Overall, it was 35 billion queries in a day, which is quite a lot of data. They also announced at the beginning of 2009, actually they announced in April, that their load early in 2009 was up to 38 billion packets in a typical day. But this is not actually why they're spending $100 million. If you think about handling this on your computer, it might sound like a lot of data. But if you think about handling this for $100 million, it's pretty easy to handle this kind of load. What VeriSign is worried about is being flooded with data. They're worried about having people just sending an incredible volume of data to their servers and overloading the servers. This has been tried twice. And so far, nobody's managed to knock all of the .com servers off the internet simultaneously. Best anybody's managed to do is half of the .com servers. But if a few more people try it, somebody will knock .com off the internet. And at that point, your machine will have google.com cached for a little while, and then eventually it'll want to know from the .com servers, hey, where's Google? And it won't find out because the .com servers are all being flooded, never to be heard from again. So VeriSign is worried about these non-typical days where their servers are being attacked. And what they've announced, what they're spending $100 million to do, is to be prepared for 4 trillion packets a day, adding up to something like, I think the way they said this was 200 gigabits per second, or in other words, 2, is that petabytes per day of traffic? Quite a lot of traffic that they would like to handle. And that's a pretty serious load. And if you imagine the number of computers and network connections to handle that, then you can understand why they're spending $100 million on this. This system, the .com servers, provide no cryptographic protection whatsoever for the responses they send back to you. They might keep running if enough money is pumped into them, but they won't provide data that you can check in any way. Anybody can forge responses from the .com servers. DNSSEC is a security project for DNS. It started in 1993. I guess that means it's in its 15th, 16th year now. And the idea of it was to provide some sort of cryptographic protection for DNS. Now, this was compromised pretty quickly by people being afraid of how much work cryptography would require, how slow cryptography would be. The DNSSEC design within the first year settled on, okay, we're not going to encrypt anything, we're just going to try to authenticate, and we can't do that on the fly because servers are going to be overloaded. Back in the 90s, okay, computers were slower, networks were slower, there was less data, but people could see that DNS servers were busy. And also, on the other side, DNS clients run by internet service providers are quite busy. So they decided that there's just no way to do cryptography for these servers that are handling billions of packets per day, scaled back to 1993. I don't know what the loads actually were then. They decided we can't do cryptography, so we're going to do the one thing we can figure out how to do, namely pre-compute public key signatures on our data. And then when the server gets a packet coming in, it'll send a response including signatures and whatever keys are necessary to understand the signatures. There's not going to be any online cryptographic computation. As a result of this decision, there are all sorts of usability problems with DNSSEC. I've actually given hour-long talks just tracing the consequences of this design decision, where having to store signatures within the DNS architecture causes all sorts of problems. Having signatures expire because you don't otherwise have any guarantee of freshness. Somebody can replay old data in DNS. This forces DNSSEC to do all sorts of screwy things, which mean that if you don't pay attention to managing it carefully, then your domain drops off the internet. And then there's problems with data that changes, data that doesn't exist. There's all sorts of problems with DNSSEC. The reason that Sweden sends back a 3,974-byte packet in response to a 31-byte request is that it's sending back DNSSEC data. Without DNSSEC, it would be much less expansion of the response. The important problem for most users with DNSSEC is just managing it. It's so hard to use DNSSEC. Maybe somebody wants to guess out of the 80 million .coms on the internet, like Google.com, Microsoft.com. Out of these 80 million star.com names currently on the internet, does anybody want to guess what percentage are using DNSSEC, have public key signatures on their DNS information saying Microsoft.com is over here? Kenny? 0.1%. Okay, I have to calculate to see what kind of ridiculously insulting statement you're making about DNSSEC there. 0.1% means I cross off 3 zeros, right? So that's 80,000 star.coms that have DNSSEC deployed. Does anybody else want to guess a less insulting or more insulting number? It turns out the DNSSEC people are keeping track of all the DNSSEC names on the internet, and there's this project, the SEC Spider, that looks for DNS security around the internet, and they have reached 300.com names with DNSSEC signatures. Now, after millions of dollars of grants, I think I can pay 300 people to add DNSSEC signatures to their .com names. This is really embarrassing. So what's going on here? Well,
but if the total number of people who service which uses it in any single moment of time.
Sorry, what's the total?
Is it accumulated number or is number?
This is the total. Well, okay. There are some cases like the Netherlands. The Netherlands administrators tried DNSSEC, and it was such an administrative hassle that they turned it off. So there have been some decreases, but anyway, it has increased somewhat over the past year. I would say over the last 6 months, it's almost doubled. So in 8 years of exponential growth, maybe we'll get the entire internet. I've heard about the internet doubling every year. So, I wonder whether the exponential growth in this number is bigger than the exponential growth in that number. Well, anyway, I realize I should also try to flip something onto the other slides here. Actually, I could go all the way back. I'll just push the green button. So, a lesson here, of course, obviously, if cryptography is too slow, people don't use it. If somebody tells you, yeah, you can put cryptography onto all your web pages, use HTTPS, but you have to buy a web accelerator or else you're server will be overloaded and can't keep up with all the users, then you'll say, I'm perfectly fine with HTTP. That's just fine. I don't really need cryptography, do I? Well, maybe you do, but you just can't afford it. More subtle, what's going on with DNS security is that if a protocol designer is just afraid that maybe the cryptography will be too slow, then they won't build it into their protocols. So they'll change it. They'll do something that prevents users from complaining about how slow the cryptography is. And that's what happened with DNSSEC, is that they decided that they have to do signatures pre-computed. There's no other cryptography that they can handle. They can't make things easier to use with online cryptography. So they really compromised usability of DNSSEC because they were concerned about servers being overloaded. Now, what does this tell us as cryptographers? Well, I think that the natural response to this for those of us who actually put together these cryptographic primitives and say, yeah, you can use RSA and elliptic curves and here's all the tricks to speed it up. Well, hey, let's see if we can actually make cryptography fast enough to encrypt and authenticate every internet packet. Maybe people don't need encryption all the time, but at least they need authentication all the time, and we should be able to handle that for every single internet packet. Can we make cryptography that's that fast? I think we can. And, well, task as a cryptographer is to actually do it and not just do it as an academic paper, but actually implement it and make it something that people really can install on their machines and really do install on their machines. They're not concerned about the speed of the cryptography. It's clearly fast enough. Protocol designers aren't going to stay away from it because of speed. How do we measure speeds? Well, there's been a lot of randomness in the literature deciding what's fast, and I think that slows people down if they don't know what's the fastest thing out there. There's an eCrypt project. One of the projects within eCrypt, which itself is a project in the EU, is to do benchmarking. The picture here starting from the EU, one of the EU networks, I think at this point the only network of excellence left in the European Union, is eCrypt 2. It's the evolution of several previous projects and networks. The NESI project and then the eCrypt 1 network have evolved into eCrypt 2, lasting till 2012. There are 11 partners in eCrypt 2, I think fewer than in previous eCrypt. It's organized, the work in eCrypt 2 is organized into several virtual labs. The one listed here is Vampire, the Virtual Application and Implementation Lab, which is led by Tanya and by Christoph Parr. There's also a lab on asymmetric stuff and a lab on symmetric stuff, which focus on the theory of that and maybe a bit on implementation, but the lab that really focuses on getting stuff working in practice and seeing how well it works is Vampire. And one of the projects within Vampire is eBACS, eCrypt Benchmarking of Cryptographic Systems. This includes eCrypt Benchmarking of Asymmetric Systems, eBACS, and eBASH for benchmarking of all submitted hashes and various other benchmarking projects. I have the pleasure of running the web pages for that. If you're interested in results, I'll tell you what kind of information you can find on here in a moment. Go to bench.cr.yp.to. Maybe I'll save the slide at this point. Inside the benchmarking framework, which you can download, there are currently 346 implementations of something, 100-something different cryptographic primitives. There's 48 Diffie-Hellman and signature and encryption public key primitives. And there's 26 different stream ciphers, like AES and counter mode and various newer stream ciphers. There's 50 different hash functions. All of these, I should maybe clarify, the numbers are maybe not quite as large as they seem because, for instance, AES, there's two different ciphers, namely 128-bit AES and 256-bit AES, and maybe there's even a 192. So, okay, there's actually not quite as many different hash functions and different stream ciphers in there as these numbers might indicate, but it's still quite a few implementations, lots of state-of-the-art implementations, public API that anybody can contribute. If you have any sort of cryptographic software and you'd like to know how fast it is, it's actually easier to just send it into us following the API, very easy to do, than to try to measure it yourself. Tanya and I collect these implementations and then run the benchmarking framework on currently 78 machines, which some of them have 32 and 64-bit modes. So there's 112 different sets of benchmarks, each of which consists of taking all these different implementations, compiling them with 1,000 different compiler options, and seeing what's the best for each of these different pieces of software, identifying those and posting lots of data on the web about how fast these are. Of course, I'm not going to show you all that data in this talk, but if you're interested in performance measurement, then go to bench.cr.yp.to. That's the application binary interface. For instance, a 32-bit program and a 64-bit program, those are different ABIs. You can't link a 32-bit program and a 64-bit program together, so if you're forced on a 64-bit machine, normally it's faster in 64-bit mode, but if you're forced to link with a 32-bit library, then you have to know the 32-bit performance of the other tools you want to use. Usually you just care about the best performance, the best APIs, the, say, 64-bit instead of 32-bit. Okay. There's a new library which has state-of-the-art tools, as demonstrated by the performance in this framework. In fact, there's an amazing synergy between the API, between this new cryptographic library and the API used for benchmarking, that somebody who's writing code for the library amazingly finds that it's benchmarkable with no effort at all, and somebody who writes code for the benchmarking amazingly finds that it can be used in the library if it meets the library's code quality constraints with no work at all. This library is part of the Computer-Aided Cryptography Engineering Project, 3-year project, which has 12 European partners, not the same list of people. There's several different work packages in this. Sometimes I describe the case that's Computer-Aided Cryptography Engineering. Sometimes I describe this project as being about low-level core 2 micro-optimization of multi-party computation of the price of sugar beets in Denmark. Actually, there is multi-party computation that has been used in practice. Somebody actually implemented it, which is amazing if you look at what's involved in multi-party computation. I mean, cryptographic multi-party computation. And it actually has been used for the price of sugar beets in Denmark and is perhaps going to be used for other applications. And the people who actually got it implemented are at kind of the top level of this project. And then there's several lower levels of getting things working for, well, at the lowest level, various compiler tools. And then slightly above the lowest level, our part of this, Tanya and I are doing the Networking Cryptography Library, NACL. There was an unfortunate name conflict. There's a newer Google project, Native Client, which also is sometimes abbreviated NACL. Don't get those confused. This is a cryptographic library. Very recently, after lots of quality assurance, we have released this library, at least the C interface to this library, at least the functions that, well, the core functions that we need for some applications. There's been some contributions from Adam Langley at Google and Matt Dembski at Mokimedia, and then, of course, lots of code we've written internally. If you're interested in this library, go to NACL. That's, of course, pronounced salt, and the C version of the library is pronounced C, salt, C, get it, C, salt, ha, ha, ha. So go to NACL, that's salt.caseproject.eu. The reasons for writing a new library, well, it's not just speed. Speed is, of course, the emphasis of this talk, but I should say here that the salt library does better than, say, OpenSSL in several ways. First of all, there's security. Secondly, there's usability, and finally, last, maybe not least, is speed. An example of security, the reason that one of the work packages in this computer-aided cryptography engineering project is on formal verification and validation, making sure your code works. The OpenSSL library announced an emergency security upgrade in January this year. And what was that upgrade for? Well, somebody had noticed that if you have a DSA signature sent to OpenSSL, DSA is a pretty common signature mechanism. I think it's also true for ECDSA, what I'm saying. If you send a DSA signature to OpenSSL, it looks at the signature and peels out a couple of numbers, from the signature. That's what a DSA signature consists of. But wait a minute, maybe the padding of those numbers is not right. Maybe it's not validly formatted. So the library, of course, checks for this. And it says, if it's an invalidly formatted signature, oh, that's not validly formatted. I guess I'll accept it. And this has been in OpenSSL, the world's most widely used cryptographic library, for a decade. And nobody noticed until now. Well, nobody publicly noticed until now. So now somebody publicly noticed, and there's this emergency security release. Of course, right now, the people who are least served by existing libraries are the ones who really need top speed. I like to say, yeah, security is important. We, of course, want to achieve better security than OpenSSL. Given examples like this DSA example, that's not too hard. We, of course, want better usability than OpenSSL. But what really clinches using a new library for people who just cannot use the previous libraries is speed. For instance, having DNS security be usable and not rely on pre-computed signatures really needs a very fast library, and that's been our initial priority for this library. Of course, we're also looking at other applications, like applications within the CASE project, like multi-party computation. The existing release does have everything we need for the critical operations in cryptography, everything you need for typical two-party communication, private communication on the internet. And you can also use it for public communication, although maybe you'd want signatures, which are not listed here, for public communication. The critical cryptographic operations are, first of all, use some sort of public key cryptography to come up with a secret key. And maybe people will say, oh, really, you want to have, like in Kenny's talk, maybe you want to have encryption rather than key agreement. Rather than NIKD, you want to have IBE in the identity-based case. Well, typically, if you do encrypt something to somebody, then you want to save some secret from that so that the next time you encrypt something, you don't have to re-encrypt with a big public key operation. You just save some secret and then use secret key cryptography after that. The reason that super fast internet applications always use things like Diffie-Hellman, some non-interactive key agreement, is that it's much, much faster to send data protected by secret key cryptography than to send it protected by public key cryptography. So we try to use public key cryptography for as little data as possible. Just share a key between two parties. And then use secret key cryptography with that shared secret key to do encryption and authentication. Now, depending on the number of clients you have and the amount of data you're transmitting per client and whether you have more forgeries or whether you're encrypting in the first place, your bottleneck in this picture might be the public key operations, or it might be the secret key encryption, or it might be the secret key authentication. Depending on the application, all of these can be critical. I'll give you more examples of that in a few slides. I won't say very much about encryption. My main emphasis today is going to be on the public key part of this. But just to give you some idea of the speeds that people see for secret key operations, the typical way to encrypt data these days is you have some nonce, some message number n, and you encrypt your nth message by simply XORing it with output of some cipher, some stream cipher, like AES in counter mode. So you take your nonce n, say it's a 64-bit nonce, and put a 64-bit counter next to it, and then count up 1, 2, 3 next to n, encrypt those blocks with AES, with, say, a 128-bit or 256-bit secret key. You get a bunch of output blocks, which look very random. Nobody can figure out what K is or any pattern in these output blocks, even though they know n, they know all the inputs. And then you just XOR that with your message. And maybe also use ASK of n, 0 for authentication with some similar procedure. But it's always very simple secret key constructions where most of the work is just computing this AES function, the Advanced Encryption Standard. Now, most libraries out there, like OpenSSL, take something like 20 cycles per byte, maybe more depending on your machine. At IndoCrypt 2008, together with one of Tanya's students, Peter Schwabe, I published 10.6 cycle per byte speeds for the Core 2, 14 cycles per byte for the Pentium 4. These are not speeds for gigantic amounts of data. It's for any reasonable amount of data. You get down to these speeds. And then Amelia Kesper said, hey, there's a different way to do the AES computation on a Core 2. It's maybe not so effective on other processors, but realistically, we all have Core 2s these days. And that gets down to 7.8 cycles per byte, very fast speeds for AES. If you're using, this is for 128-bit keys. If you're using 256-bit keys, then it's maybe more like 10 cycles per byte. But still remarkably fast compared to, say, the 20 cycles per byte that people normally have. for AES. Now, you can get much better speeds if this is not fast enough. Imagine you have a machine running billions of cycles per second, and then it's trying to do 7.8 cycles per byte of data coming in. Then, well, that means that you can only handle, say, half a gigabyte of data per second, depending on exactly how fast your machine is. And maybe that's more than your network capacity is. Maybe you're only handling a gigabit per second of data coming in. But you probably want your computer doing something else, aside from just the stream cipher. So it's probably good to have your cipher only take, say, a third of your CPU time instead of all of your CPU time. It's usually not good to have your computer completely devoted to doing cryptography and no time to do anything else. There's certainly a lot of interest in faster ciphers. Another eCrypt project, the eCrypt Stream Cipher project in 2004 said, okay, there's two reasons that people want to improve on AES. One of them is for hardware. People want really small cryptography. But there's a talk about software. And for software, eStream said, we want fast software ciphers, something faster than AES. Because there are applications, video encryption. People really want faster encryption than they can get from AES. And they don't want their video encryption box to be totally devoted to cryptography, because they also have to do video processing. So 4 years later, the eStream project announced, OK, here's four fast software ciphers that have resisted all the attacks. And also, they announced some hardware ciphers like Trivium, which is it's just an 80-bit key. I wouldn't use it for high security applications, but it's remarkably simple and resisted all attacks. On the software side, for instance, one of my ciphers is one of the final four here, and it runs at 2.6 cycles per byte instead of the 7.8, which is the current record for AES. And it's something about as conservative as AES. It's still quite a gap between that and what anybody can break for 256-bit keys, actually. This is maybe better to compare to 10 cycles per byte for AES, 256-bit keys. Okay, so that's the kind of activity happening for secret key cryptography. And if you say, what does this all mean together with all sorts of slides I omitted on how fast authentication is, suppose you have a typical computer these days with a reasonably modern processor, but don't go overboard. Don't buy one of these $10,000 Sun supercomputers that takes up an entire machine room. Just get a normal computer with a normal processor, low cost. And how much does a processor cost? Well, I looked on Price Grabber, and it was, depending on which shop you go to, something like $200 to get an Intel Core 2 Quad Q9300, which is a four-core CPU, as the quad suggests, running at 2.5 gigahertz. And then if you add in a motherboard and a disk drive and a case with a power supply, all the other bits you need to actually run a computer, put a computer together, costs something like $400. Sorry, this is U.S. dollars again. Actually, how is U.S. dollar doing versus Canadian dollar?
Its derivative is not good.
Its derivative is not good. Okay. So maybe I should augment each of these $400 with little pictures of what that actually means in normal Canadian currency. Anyway, if you ask how much can this $400 or whatever it is in your local currency computer cost you, then how much can this actually do? Well, on these four cores, each one's running at 2.5 billion cycles per second. And that's a total of 10 to the 10th cycles per second that the CPU can carry out. That's what the 2.5 gigahertz quad means. And now you translate that into, for some reasonable size of packet doing encryption and authentication, how many packets can you handle? Well, something like 10 to the 11th. Maybe for 500 byte packets might be 1.4 times 10 to the 11th packets per day. And then if you have a typical high-speed gigabit per second network, then you can keep up with that on this $400 computer and still have 80 or so percent of your time left to do other stuff. You're not spending all your time on cryptography. You can actually continue to get processing done. And if you tell a user, okay, you can have your whole computer, well, okay, you have to give up 10%, 20% for cryptography, maybe they're willing to do that. For $400, that's the kind of computation power you get. That's the kind of network you can keep up with state-of-the-art encryption and authentication. Now, I said the focus of this talk is public key cryptography, and now I realize I've been completely ignoring the flip doohickey, so in case anybody wants to keep referring to this. All right, what about public key cryptography? Of course, a public key operation is much, much slower than a secret key operation. On the other hand, hopefully you're not doing it so often. So public key operation, well, the example I've written down here at a conservative security level is a 256-bit scalar multiplication on an elliptic curve. You have a field of, say, 256 bits, say a prime around 2 to the 256, and you compute, given a point P on an elliptic curve over that field, chosen to be a secure elliptic curve as far as we know, and given a 256-bit integer N, compute N times P. Now, every time you see a new public key from somebody and want to do a Diffie-Hellman exchange with them, then you have to do one of these single scalar multiplications, which is many, many more than 2.6 cycles. We're talking more than 100,000 cycles, maybe millions of cycles, depending on your software. And what if this happens frequently? What if you have to do billions and billions of these public key operations? You can try to remember the computations you've done, remember your Diffie-Hellman shared secret, and use it again and again for secret key cryptography. But what happens if there's too many to remember? And you just have so many different clients that they're just cycling between more public keys than you can remember. Or worst case, what if you're under attack and somebody's sending you a whole bunch of public keys, each of which is very short, and they're trying to flood your CPU with work that you cannot keep up with? Well, hopefully they won't be able to reflect their new public keys off of somebody. Hopefully the amplifiers out there, like this 100 times reflector that I talked about on the first slide, hopefully those won't reflect new public keys to people. But even if somebody just directly sends you a new public key, new public key, new public key, new public key, using up their network capacity, can your CPU keep up with that? It's not clear. Just because you can handle secret key cryptography quickly doesn't mean that you can handle public key cryptography quickly enough. I was looking at this some years ago and said, okay, I can do pretty fast software for elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman and announce the speed of, depending on your processor, say 600,000 cycles, 640,000 on a Pentium M, depending on your CPU, maybe Pentium 4 is more like 900,000 cycles. But if you choose a sensible elliptic curve and write your software sensibly doing sensible things for arithmetic, then you get more than twice as fast as previous elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman for that conservative security level. The particular curve I chose was this curve y squared equals x cubed plus 486662x squared plus x mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. And this is using Montgomery's ideas for how to do elliptic curve computations quickly, this particular curve shape, and the number there is chosen to be to make this curve secure and twist secure, so the number of points on the curve is essentially a prime, 8 times a prime. The number of points on the twist of the curve is 4 times a prime. And then there's various other security constraints on this, and then subject to that, want that number to be small. Lots of reasons to choose all the details here. And when I implemented it, found, yeah, it's nice and fast, and this is pretty good speed, but it's certainly not state-of-the-art now. At ECC 2007, Gaudry and Tomei said, okay, we've got a new fast 64-bit library which is easy to use and generates fast code for doing arithmetic mod 2 to the 255 minus 19 or other primes. So this MPFQ library is something which is kind of generic, and you can tell it, okay, I'd like to do arithmetic in this field. Please give me code that does arithmetic quickly in this field. And they, using this, came up with some 64-bit code for exactly the same curve, which instead of 600,000 cycles was taking only 300-something thousand cycles. Do I have a mouse here? Yeah, here we go. 386,000 cycles for exactly the same elliptic curve on a Core 2. And they also looked at other cases. The year before, Pierrick Gaudry had come up with some really fast formulas for genus 2. And implementing those, well, he had just a little bit slower results on the Core 2, 400,000 cycles. The problem here, the reason, even though his formulas are really, really cool, and analysis says they should be faster, considerably faster than genus 1 formulas at the same security level, the problem is that he wasn't able to find a genus 2 curve with small coefficients in his parameterization. At least not with security, not an example which was simultaneously the number of points on the curve, the number of points on the twist being some small cofactor times various primes. Now this is, it's within reach to compute a small example. So to go through his curves with small coefficients and check each one, count the number of points, it should be maybe, was it a few weeks per?
1 month, 1 month and a half.
1 month and a half per curve, and then you have to go through maybe 100,000 curves.
No.
Well, depending on the cofactor.
A couple of times.
Okay, a couple thousand curves. So it sounds like a few thousand months.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're halfway already?
Yeah.
You mean you've had 1,000 failures already?
Not quite, but we had a secure one.
Okay. Something like 1% of curves are secure and only 1% of those are twist secure, so it's cheating a little bit to say you're halfway through the conditions. But yeah, it sounds like this computation is not yet done, but suddenly it'll be done, and then thanks to the continued computations by Gaudry and Schultz, we will have some fast genus 2 curves. To understand what kind of speed up we're talking about here, you can look at the binary analog. Now, of course, binary couldn't possibly compete with non-binary in software because, CPUs have big integer multipliers, maybe floating point multipliers, whatever the multipliers are, they're not for binary. Maybe Intel's talking about next year doing some fast binary multiplier, maybe not so fast. At least they'll try some instruction. PCLMulk2DQ is going to be in the new Intel chips to do binary. But any current processor, you can't possibly do binary at competitive speeds. But you can still look at the results. 687,000 cycles versus 888,000 cycles. And that's because genus 2 is faster than genus 1. And in the binary case, it's easy to come up with a secure twist secure curve. And you should expect similar kinds of speed ups in the non-binary case. So instead of 386,000 cycles, once we have a good curve, it'll be clearly under 300,000 cycles, switching to genus 2. But for the moment, well, genus 2 just doesn't have a curve that makes people happy. So, save slides now. What do these speeds mean for VeriSign? More than $100 million spent on upgrading computers and networks to be able to handle 4 trillion packets per day. How much public key computation does that involve? Well, suppose that every one of these packets has a new public key where you have to do a new Diffie-Hellman, a new single scalar multiplication, another of these operations. What do these cycle counts mean for this number of curve 25519 operations every day? Well, do a little bit of division. And it turns out to be under 2,000 computers, where computers means these $400 computers with Core 2 quads. Multiplying, that sounds like under $1 million to handle all of the packets, even if it's the absolute worst case of somebody flooding them with a new public key in every packet. Now, okay, $1 million is quite a bit of money, but compared to $100 million, I think they can afford it. If that's what they need to do the cryptography, then I think they should be able to do that. On the other hand, maybe they say, what, $1 million? Can't you make it $500,000? Well, okay, there's continuing reasons to try to make things faster. And maybe you want to handle a bigger flood. Maybe you don't have $100 million to spend. Certainly, this is not the end of high-speed cryptography. So, of course, there's continuing interest in doing even better. Save slide now. Recently, there have been 3 completely different ways of improving these speeds. Aside from hoping to switch to genus 2, which should also be combinable, so maybe I should say 4 ways that we're getting better speeds. And all of them should be things we can put together. The first way, MPFQ actually takes a step backwards from the software that was there previously, that it's not really using the CPU instructions efficiently. And Neil Kostkin and Sam Peter Schwabe wrote a paper which is going to be at Africa Crypt this year, where they said, hey, we can use PlayStations and sensible use of the CPU multiplier on the PlayStations to get new speed records for public key cryptography using the same elliptic curve. And then Wei Dai said, hey, you know, let's transport those ideas back to the Core 2 and gets, well, he's not done with the implementation, but it's clear it'll be somewhat faster than the speeds from Gaudry and Tomei, just by using the CPU better, scheduling instructions better, making more sensible use of the instructions that are there. Now, second thing that's produced a very noticeable speed up is a big extension of the set of GLV curves by GLS. Well, Galbraith, Lin, and Scott announced at ECC 2008 and also follow-up paper at Eurocrypt 2009 where they sensibly did the Edwards version of this, at least in the talk. The paper doesn't really exploit Edwards yet, but they say take an elliptic curve over FP where P is just 128 bits or 127 bits, and then take the same elliptic curve over FP squared, and now it's got this piece powering endomorphism, and then twist the curve so that you can actually hope for security, obviously not twist security, with this construction, but at least you can hope for security and then change your protocol to deal with non-twist secure curves. And then you still have a fast endomorphism, which you use in a GLV, Gallant Lambert Vanstone type algorithm, and you get amazingly fast speeds which compensate for all the overheads that you would initially see here. The current software is actually being benchmarked and uses this Edwards curve, x squared plus y squared equals 1 plus 42 x squared y squared, mod 2 to the 127 minus 1. Well, it uses that curve extended and twisted appropriately, and by putting together some algorithmic tricks gets a pretty serious speed up on a core i7 at something like 260,000 cycles, which is newer than a core 2, but in any case, it's very impressive speeds. And then the third thing which I'd like to tell you about in some detail is something I'll be presenting at Crypto this year, which, again, is completely different. All these things should be combinable, so I would expect that in the long run we'll have something which is genus 2 and using what I'm about to tell you about and using this type of endomorphism, or maybe the extreme case of something like Koblitz curves, and also using the CPU instruction sensibly. Everything should come together. Let me tell you about just this last bit, and then I'll leave it to you after the talk to think about how to combine all these ideas. To tell you about this something completely different, I have to tell you a little more about Edwards curves. So let me remind you first of what you've heard about Edwards curves, just a little bit so that I'll start from. An Edwards curve, as you know, is a curve x squared plus y squared equals 1 plus d x squared y squared in odd characteristic or characteristic 0, with the very simple addition law shown here. Not just simple, also fast, but okay, it's very simple. And you heard that every elliptic curve over k that has a point of order 4 can be very easily transformed, is birationally equivalent to one of these Edwards curves. And then you also heard about the completeness of these curves. It's funny, actually, the curves that Edwards originally introduced were tantamount to D being a fourth power. And in that case, he never got these non-square cases. And just by slightly tweaking the formulas to generalize to arbitrary Ds that weren't fourth powers, we suddenly had these non-square cases with a complete addition law. So that, as Tanya mentioned, says that the denominators here in the addition law, assuming D is chosen to be not a square, those denominators are never zero. The addition laws always work. The set of affine points on this Edwards curve forms a commutative group. This might seem to contradict a theorem of Bosma and Lenstra, which says, here I'm quoting from their paper, says the smallest cardinality of a complete system of addition laws on E equals 2. So if you have a set of addition laws that's complete, that can add every pair of points, then you have to have at least 2. And they give an example of 2 addition laws. Now here we have an addition law on an elliptic curve with 1 addition law, and it's complete. So what's going on here? Well, you look at what the theorem says, and it says that if you have a Weierstrass curve in projective coordinates, and you then look at all the possible additions of points over k bar, the algebraic closure of k, then you have to have exceptional cases for any addition formula. Now, the critical point here, I don't think Weierstrass matters. What matters here is the k bar. If you look at exactly this addition formula, as Tanya mentioned, if you put a square root of d into your field, as soon as you go not all the way up to k bar, just go to k joined square root of d, then suddenly you've got exceptional cases. Well, you can, in that case, just look at the points on the Weierstrass curve that you mentioned that correspond to certain points that now are on this Edwards curve, and just do some addition that ends up with one of those points, and it's not an affine point anymore. So clearly, the addition formula fails. You can manufacture failure cases, at least if k is not, well, if it's more than like 10 elements, then you can manufacture exceptional cases over k joined square root of d. On the other hand, in cryptography, we don't care about this because we specify a k and we look at points on the elliptic curve or the Edwards curve over k, and we never encounter these exceptions that are guaranteed by the Bosma-Lenstra theorem. Completeness is certainly very convenient. Tanya mentioned that it makes life easy for the implementer, and of course also if you're trying to prove things. It's also nice if you're worried about side channel attacks. You don't have to worry about the somebody just hearing the difference between addition and doubling, addition, doubling, addition, addition, doubling, doubling, doubling. So Okay, it certainly, among the many advantages of Edwards curves are the fact that you've got this unified, and not just unified, but no exceptions at all, complete addition formula that you can just always use it again and again and again, and from a side channel perspective, somebody just hears you're doing addition, 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 and has no idea what the pattern of additions is. So, okay, it's a nice feature of Edwards, but what if for some reason you're stuck with something that doesn't work in Edwards form? For instance, hey, what if you have one of those BN curves that we just heard can't be transformed to Edwards form? Or what if somebody gives you the old NIST standard curves, which all have prime order, so they certainly don't have a point of order 4? Or what if you have an elliptic curve over a binary field? It's maybe even more fundamental than the number of points on the curve. It started by saying, hey, we've got an odd characteristic or characteristic 0 field. So, I guess already in 2007 we were starting to think about this. Tanya and I have been setting out as a project, and to some extent completing this, for every elliptic curve, you could ask this as a question, what is the fastest complete addition law for that curve? Of course, you could also ask this without the word complete. In that case, I think it's an older, more traditional question. Already the Chudnovsky brothers were asking it. They didn't maybe come up with the best answers, but at least they were trying to come up with, for every elliptic curve, find an addition law which is as fast as possible. But actually, Edwards tells us, at least for these non-square cases, for D, Edwards tells us, hey, we can actually do something better. We've got these Edwards curves that have complete addition laws. So how fast can we make complete addition laws for other curves? Maybe it's not reasonable to expect these to be as fast as Edwards, but maybe it's something that people still find interesting. So we started thinking about this, and maybe I'll copy that. What I'm going to do on the next few slides is give you the design choices that we made in writing down some more general curve shapes. And some of these are kind of forced by considerations like we want to have an elliptic curve. Other things are not forced. I'll get to those later. But seeing the genus of a curve, seeing that a curve has genus 1, is pretty easy in most cases. There are some degenerate cases where the pictures here are misleading, but for practically all polynomials you write down in x and y, you can just look at what's going on in these pictures. 1, x, x squared, x cubed, x to the fourth. 1, y squared, x squared, x squared, y squared. The dots there are at 1, x squared, y squared, and x squared, y squared. Those are the monomials that show up in the Edwards form. And then the other pictures you can see at the top, short Weierstrass has a 1, an x cubed, and a y squared. And then Montgomery would be shifting over the 1 and the x to x and x squared. And Jacobi Quartix Hessians have 1, x cubed, xy, and y cubed. And now, an observation by Baker from 1893 is that you can just look at these Newton polygons. You take the dots there and draw the convex hull of the dots. And then the number of interior points, which is 1 in each of these pictures, is, for generic choices of coefficients, the genus of the curve. Now, you might also look at non-generic cases, but okay, let's just take the cases where Baker's formula is correct. If you want a modern proven version of this, there's, for instance, a paper by Balin and Pelikan from 2000. You can also look at, if you're interested in all the possibilities here, there's a paper by Bjorn Poonen and Fernando Rodriguez Videjas, which classifies all of these polygons that have one interior point, the elliptic curves, if you like, up to some equivalence. So, with this in mind, what did we try doing to generalize Edwards? Well, first decision was, let's try to make something that looks like Edwards. Have it be quadratic in each variable. And then let's do something which is maybe violated a little bit by say, twisted Edwards curves don't quite have the XY symmetry that original Edwards does. But let's start by exploring completely symmetric formulas where you can just flip X and Y and you have the same coefficients. So here's coefficients of 1, X squared, Y, XY, etc., and the coefficient of x will insist is the same as the coefficient of y. So here's the curve shape, d00 plus d10 times x plus y plus etc., just quadratic terms, and most quadratic in x and y. Is this curve genus 1? Is it going to have complete addition formulas? Will it have points at infinity? Well, we can figure this out generically. So let's start. Maybe the most important thing is what's going on at infinity, which depends very much on whether D22 is 0 or not, because that tells you whether this is quartic or cubic. If D22 is 0, then this is a cubic equation. F defined it, homogenized it here. So if you take the same curve equation, cross out the D22, and then stick in Z's to make everything cubic, which is the maximum degree in X and Y that we started with, maximum total degree in X and Y, then, okay, there's the homogeneous curve equation from which you can see the points at infinity. And I should say, this is, you might nitpick that D21, if D21 were 0, then this would not be the right homogenization. It should divide out another Z. But because we are insisting on genus 1, when we draw the convex hull around that picture, we have to get 1, 1 as an interior point if we're in the Baker case. So that means D21 has to be non-zero. So it is, this is the homogenization. We're not going to have D21 equals 0. And now we can look at the points at infinity, which are plug in Z equals 0. And you see most of the terms disappear. You just have the top degree term in X and Y. There's X equals 0 or Y equals 0 or X equals minus Y. There's 3 points at infinity. And if you look at them and plug in X equals 1, for instance, along with expanding Z around 0, then you get a curve equation that is non-singular. Just glancing at this equation, all I've done here is substituted Z equals little z and y equals little y and x equals 1. And that curve equation now has a non-zero coefficient of y. Singular would be the coefficient of y is 0, the coefficient of x is, I mean singular at 0, 0 would be the coefficient of y is 0, the coefficient of x is 0, and the constant coefficient is 0. And here the coefficient of y is non-zero. Sorry, when I said x, I meant z. The coefficient of y is clearly non-zero. It's D21. So that means this point at infinity is non-singular. And as Tanya said, if you have a non-singular point at infinity, you're going to bump into it by doing additions. So you cannot possibly have a complete addition law, unless you had an elliptic curve with so few points that you can't manufacture 2 points adding up to that point at infinity that are themselves affine. But except for non-cryptographically interesting cases, the addition law cannot be complete when you have a non-singular point at infinity. So this D22 equals 0 is not compatible with having a complete addition law, so we're going to insist on D22 being non-zero. And now I think I'll skip over the details here. You can go through analyzing the points at infinity, which look very much like what happens with Edwards. And then you end up concluding that there's 2 points at each of the two point. If you blow up 1, 0, 0, you get 2 points on the desingularization, which correspond to one of their coefficients is exactly roots of this quadratic. Well, the 2 points correspond to the 2 roots of that quadratic. If that quadratic is irreducible, then as in the Edwards case, the blowups are not defined over k. They're defined over k joined square root of d. In the Edwards case, if you trace through all this with Edwards, then you get this quadratic, the sort of top terms in the terms, the coefficients of x squared, or the coefficients of y squared. In the Edwards case, are just 1 minus du squared. And if d is not a square, that's irreducible. And that's what tells you that the points at infinity blow up irrationally. If the quadratic were reducible, then we would have non-singular points at infinity, and again, would not have a complete addition law. So this quadratic being irreducible tells us a lot about the curve shape. We know that D20, if this is irreducible, D20 has to be non-zero along with D22. And that means that in the Newton polygon, we can already identify some sides. And at this point, we said, OK, we're not trying to rebuild exactly Edwards. Let's do something different. Let's actually have D00 being 0. You can make other choices. And this is not necessarily the best choice, but it's something to explore. And that from the genus, assuming Baker, requires D10 to be non-zero. So now we know the whole Newton polygon. This is a variant of Edwards, which has a lot more parameters to play with. We still have to make one more decision to pin down what this is as an elliptic curve, namely, where's the neutral element? And we decided, this is, again, not necessarily the best thing, but we decided to put the neutral element at 0, 0, which is on the curve since D00 is 0. You could say, well, really, both these last decisions are saying 0, 0 is the neutral element, and that implies D00 is 0. But you can separate the decisions, and it's not clear that you should make 0, 0 the neutral element, even if D00 is 0. Anyway, choosing 0, 0 as the neutral element forces the negative of x, y to be y, x, as a warning, if you choose other neutral elements, you can write down elliptic curves. You can even write down elliptic curves with fast doublings, fast additions, and surprisingly slow negations. Maybe negations not as slow as additions, but compared to what we're used to, negations can be very bad. We decided to have 0, 0 as a neutral element, which makes nice fast negations. So just swap the x and y. And at this point, we've pretty much pinned down what this variant of Edwards looks like. We have several parameters which we can play with. They're clearly lying in a P4 a priori, but you can do more by scaling x and y by some factor. There's really just 3 degrees of freedom here. We started by analyzing this in the binary case, and together with another of Tanya's students, Reza Ayan Farashahi, hope I pronounced that right, came up with a complete addition law for the special case that you see there, where D1, 0, and D2, 0 are abbreviated D1 and D2, and the other Ds are chosen to be 1. This one, well, you can prove that, except for very tiny fields, this covers all ordinary binary elliptic curves. If you want supersingular, you have to choose coefficients differently, but this covers every elliptic curve over a binary finite field with order divisible by 2, which, aside from those weird supersingular curves, is everything people use. Well, it's everything out there aside from supersingular curves. And also, the formulas that we wrote down are surprisingly fast. They're actually as fast as anything else out there, and in some cases faster. So we get completeness with no sacrifice in speed. Unlike Edwards, this wasn't improving on the speeds that were out there before, but binary Edwards is just as fast as everything before and complete. And then we started looking, those continuing projects, started looking at the non-binary case in the same way. And we have all the NIST curves. For instance, here's a curve of the same form, x squared plus y squared equals x plus y plus txy plus dx squared y squared. This fits into the shape that I've been describing. If you take d equals minus 1, t equals whatever over some particular field, then you can easily see, this is with a little calculation, birationally equivalent to the standard NIST P256 curve. Feel free to do this in your head. I suppose I'll leave it up there for those of you who like calculation. And here's the addition law for that. Okay, that's enough about the addition law. This is, okay, you can prove with a little bit of work that the denominators here are never zero if d is not a square. And the d non-square, again, just look at the curve shape there and say, what's the coefficient of x squared? It's 1 on the left and a dy squared on the right. 1 minus dy squared, that's irreducible if d is not a square. And, okay, you have to do more work to prove completeness, as Tanya was warning you, but this particular addition law is complete. I think in the interest of time, I'll skip comments on how easy it is to come up with addition laws and tell you last little bit about batch binary Edwards. So this, I said there was a completely different way of improving on the previous speeds for public key cryptography. And here it is. Maybe I should emphasize, as you see a slide with all these bit operations and some source, I really am talking about software speeds for elliptic curve cryptography, no weird hardware stuff. But nevertheless, here's just a statement, a mathematical statement. If you want to multiply 251-bit polynomials, polynomials of degree at most 250 over F2, you can do that with, well, if you did it with school book multiplication, it would take 125,000 bit operations, bit operation being a plus or a times over F2, an AND or an XOR. But you can actually do it with 33,200 bit operations. Now, there's a huge gap here between 125,000 and 33,000, and of course most of that gap was closed previously. If you just use Karatsuba in a not too stupid way, then you get to something like 40,000. But you can do better than that and get down to 33,000. There's quite a bit to say about how fast multiplication is, in part over F2 and in part in general. And now, moving up from field multiplication to elliptic curve operations, if you take the representation of F2 to the 251 shown there, K is F2 adjoined T mod some particular degree 251 irreducible with, in this case, all the coefficients is T all the remaining monomials shoved to the right as far as possible, low degree. This is a typical choice of irreducible. And then you choose D in a slightly trickier way, shown on the top there. Then the corresponding binary Edwards curve with D1 equals D and D2 equals D. So the binary Edwards curve, D times X plus X squared plus Y squared equals X plus X squared times Y plus Y squared. That curve satisfies all the security criteria that people normally write down, including the ridiculous ones that have no justification, like discriminant has to be gigantic and you can't use subfields, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very secure curve as far as we know, including crackpot notions of security. And then for this curve, you can do elliptic curve scalar multiplication using, well, a certain number of multiplications and additions, and you count the total number of operations. It's about 45 million bit operations. What does this have to do with software speed? I'll get back to that. Bear with me. The number of bit operations here benefits from the binary Edwards curve providing, first of all, a small number of multiplications. It's fast in the traditional sense and being complete. If you try to write down a straight line sequence of operations, a circuit with no branches, you just get to do pluses and times over F2 and then deal with an if. If P equals Q, do this. If P is minus Q, do that. If P is infinity, do this. It drastically expands the size of your circuit. I don't know exactly what the total expansion would be, but it's very, very convenient and certainly helps this 45 million number to have complete operations on the binary Edwards curve. So now here's my last slide. Even though counting bit operations might sound like some weird hardware thing to do only if you're building chips for multiplication or for elliptic curve cryptography, it's actually very closely connected to software speed if you use what's called bit slicing, where you do, say, 128 parallel operations. You have 128-bit vectors on the core 2, which you can add and multiply. Well, you can AND them and XOR them with other 128-bit vectors, which is doing 128 parallel circuits, 128 parallel bit operations, as long as you're doing exactly the same operations on all 128 inputs at the same time. Again, completeness is very helpful for this. And now, if you asked for these 45 million bit operations, how long would that take to handle 128 scalar multiplications in parallel? Well, you take 45 million bit operations, you divide by 128 inputs, and then you say, actually, the core 2 can do 3 vector operations every cycle. So you could hope for these 45 million operations to take as few as 117,000 cycles. And any improvements in the 45 million would reduce that lower bound. Actually, at this point, I'm a little below the 45 million. But, so 117,000 is the lower bound, which would be quite an improvement over the 386,000 I was mentioning before. Now, at the moment, the prototype code that I submitted the paper to crypto with, that is nowhere near the 117,000 because there's all sorts of bottlenecks to deal with in instruction scheduling. And so the code is just speed records in February for public key cryptography. It's not the impressive speed records I'm hoping for. I mean, 346,000 is less than 386,000, but at the same time, there's other improvements that are getting down below this. Again, everything should be combinable. In this case, the main work to do is exactly instruction scheduling, and I've been doing compiler tools, which, once they're done, should be improving this considerably. I don't know how close I'll get to the 100,000, but it should be considerably better than 300,000, maybe even beating 200,000. And again, all this should be combined with, say, using a Koblitz curve, as long as you're not scared of Koblitz curves, using a genus 2 curve, genus 2 equivalent of Koblitz, put together all the ideas that are out there, and I wouldn't be surprised if public key elliptic curve, well, maybe, or hyperelliptic curve operations can be made faster than 100,000 cycles. Thanks for your attention. Yeah, it could be faster. There's all sorts of interesting speed ups out there, and one of the difficulties that I've always been facing is if I take some set of formulas, and then in the literature we have in the explicit formulas database some hundreds of formulas just for elliptic curves, without things like you know, do an extension, take trace zero, and so on. And without things like, oh, there's a subfield, and you'll try writing down X, Y, Z, where Z is in the subfield. That's an idea of Aoki. And there's all sorts of cute little tricks to speed things up. And what I've decided to do to try to actually be able to get through all these things is focus on compiler tools, like the instruction schedulers, which automate as much as possible so that hopefully we can go through the entire explicit formulas database, machine chugs away for a while and says, actually, the fastest code is from this, and minimize the human time involved. And then also hopefully be able to handle all sorts of other ideas like, yeah, not just genus 2, but trace 0 is sort of, I think of it like an intermediate genus. I mean, in terms of security and speed, it's somehow between genus 1 and genus 2. And yeah, it could well be faster. Oh, yeah. Also, the binary case is very easy to get secure and twist secure. So all of that stuff about point counting could become obsolete in the grand new world of binary curve cryptography. If you're signing the odd message once in a while, you probably don't care about cryptographic speed. Yeah. Yeah. And certainly other people have considered batching before, and there have been some papers with slight speed-ups from batching. In the end, I look at the speed records that are out there for software cryptography, and none of them have used batching. If you look actually in Montgomery's old paper on from 1987 on, they looked at curve method. He says, well, you know, we could do projective coordinates, or we could use affine coordinates, and oh, there's all these inversions, but you know, there's this little trick of doing 1 over x and 1 over y by doing 1 over xy, and suddenly the inversions in batch become very, very cheap. But he says, well, he tried it both ways, and it's about the same performance. So he didn't really, in his optimized implementation, he didn't really gain speed, actually didn't gain any speed from doing batching. And similarly, people have looked at it before, and sometimes depending how good their non-batch code is, they might gain speed from batching. I think this is the first case of batching producing, well, more than a factor of 2 speed up.
I just mentioned that for class polynomial computation time, I mentioned the other day, you use affine coordinates
batching. Okay. Yeah, other classic examples, the number field sieve becomes faster if you batch inputs. Discrete log computations become faster if you batch. On the other hand, batching multiplication, that's maybe a little lower level than the usual batch applications.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take the speaker again.